Of all the reckonings to come out of the Me Too movement so far, the case of the R&B star R. Kelly has been a glaring omission for years. Allegations of abuse have followed R. Kelly for 3 decades. And to be clear, it's not the story of a star just hooking up with a groupie. Kelly has been accused of something like running a cult. Women have said that they were kept in his home as prisoners, abused physically and emotionally. A sex tape emerged and was viewed around the country, and it seemed to show that Kelly was molesting a minor. He was tried in 2008 and acquitted. Kelly has denied everything, and by and large, his fans and everyone around him have stuck by him. That may finally be changing because of a 6-part documentary called Surviving R. Kelly, which just aired on Lifetime. A Georgia DA is now investigating Kelly, and there were protests last week at his record label, covered on WNYC News.
We are tired of their silence. We are tired of the news cycle moving on, ignoring the brave testimony, stories, and fights of Black survivors.
We believe
Black survivors. We believe Black survivors.
We believe Black survivors. We believe Black survivors.
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb wrote this: an expose typically indicts the character of its subject. Surviving R. Kelly indicts a public that knew of his character and did nothing about it, a public that constructed an elaborate architecture of denial and has chosen to live in it. Jelani Cobb sat down to talk with Dream Hampton, the documentary's producer.
Just want to start with a basic question, which is, who is R. Kelly?
He is both a beloved, songwriter and singer who, I'm from Detroit, and he is someone who made music for Black people in the Midwest who do this thing called stepping, who have loved R&B, even as hip-hop came and went. Maybe hip-hop is still here, I don't know. But he's also a man who has had an open secret. And we've known who this man is for a very long time in terms of him being a predator.
You and I are in the same age range, and so you were one of the first people in our generation that was really kind of carving a niche as a music journalist. And one of the notable things about it has been your writing on specifically these questions of misogyny and sexism and the way that patriarchy has operated in popular culture. And I wondered, what were you thinking about when Lifetime approached you?
Quite frankly, I'm not a reality. I like cooking shows and home. I like Home Network, but I don't watch Buna Murray, and I thought they were going to do some silly reenactment thing. And when they told me that they were interested in a more serious approach, something that they'd never done before, I thought it was a time that I could redeem myself for a profile I had done of R. Kelly in Vibe magazine of 2000, where I just kind of wrote about his process. This was post his marriage to Aaliyah, but pre Jim DeRogatis writing about all of his predatory behavior and the lawsuits about him. I felt so whack about how that happens. Like my article coming out in November and then Jim's reporting coming out in December, that I never wrote another magazine profile on an artist again.
BuzzFeed has published an explosive report detailing accusations against artist R. Kelly.
According to the report, he's keeping a household of young women in a cult-like atmosphere.
The accusations coming from a 9-month-long investigative report.
And just to take a step back about this, when you say Aaliyah, Aaliyah was a 15-year-old rising R&B artist and under the tutelage of R. Kelly at the time, and then, of course, notably came out and Vibe magazine published the documents around it that R. Kelly had married her at age 15 when he was at that time in his late 20s.
And I think a lot of this explaining that you're having to do for your audience is another part of the reason that I did it. R. Kelly is uniquely our problem. And by our problem, I mean Black folks. He didn't really cross over. He had a crossover hit. Even the songs that he wrote for other people like Maxwell or you know, Michael Jackson and arguably even Celine Dion were R&B hits.
Going back 10 years ago, I was involved in an effort that had what I thought was a modest objective in my naivete, which was that we were requesting that radio stations not play his music during the trial. I thought that his music being played on the radio sent a very contrary message to young women who were dealing with issues of sexual violence and assault. And, you know, a group of us said that, you know, just for the time of this trial, his music shouldn't be on the radio. And the blowback that we got was so extreme. I look at it now as almost a kind of awakening experience. One of the things that you saw with him were groups of people outside the courthouse, and you include some of that in the documentary, the footage of that. But groups of people, very many of them women, very many of them young women, and they were there in support of him. And it was very difficult to hear anything to the contrary, that despite these allegations, there was very much a kind of closing ranks around him.
I wasn't following the trial as closely in 08, so when I did a deep dive for this docuseries, Geronda Pace, one of his more, you know, vocal victims, a person who broke her NDA, a young woman still, she's not 26 yet, met him as one of those 11th mm-hmm. grade supporters. So he was at his trial, on trial for having sex with an underage girl, and he was cruising 11th graders on that trial. The hubris.
Hmm.
And he grabbed me, and then we started kissing. And he started fondling my breast. And I stopped him, and I said, I'm a virgin. And he said, well, that's perfect. That means I get to train you, and I get to take your virginity.
So that is among a number of really heinous allegations that come up in the documentary. You know, physical abuse, sexual abuse, starvation, people being isolated, kept from their families, and so on. What was the hardest thing for you to film?
Well, sitting with each survivor was a marathon kind of experience. I mean, it was hours on top of hours in a studio, just facing them. There was not one of those stories that was not hard. The stuff that as a filmmaker that I was most proud of, and in episode 5, I fought for every frame, and that was the rescue of Dominique by her mother, Michelle Kramer. And we've flown Michelle in to do what all the other principals had done, which was to sit in front of this green screen and talk to me face to face, you know, for 4 or 5 hours. And Michelle said, I don't want to come to the studio. She said, I want to look for my child. Legal told us we could not suggest this to her. We could only mm-hmm. follow what she was going to do.
Oh, right. Please, come home. She cried like a little girl just hurting for her mommy. And then I said, baby, how can I come back, please? And she said, yes, Mama, come back at 6.
One of the things that people got on the other side of it was, you know, criticism that they thought that was a kind of tabloid spectacle. Was there a reason why, you know, Ms. Kramer didn't call the authorities or...
Well, try to call the authorities about a missing person over than 18. Then tell them that it's an intergender, possibly romantic thing. Then tell them that that missing person is a black girl. Mm-hmm. She has called the police. They all have called the police. Maybe we didn't do a good job of like showing that again and again. They don't get a response from the police. You'll remember mm-hmm. that the police were called on Michelle Kramer. They called mm-hmm. the police on this mother.
Right.
So that the police are, it's this idea that they're like some, you know, there's some police squad waiting to drop out of the ceiling to rescue black girls is a fantasy. Quite frankly, I didn't know we were invested in until the last week on Twitter.
On this question about black girls and women, do you think R. Kelly would be a free man if the young women making the allegations against him were white?
I don't. But then I don't find that question very useful, you know? I think that people prey on people that they have access to. You know, this is the reason why the question by the right, the extreme right, the Stormfront folks and the Breitbart folks about, you know, black on black crime, you know, even that invention of that phrase is so wrong. And I know you've written about this. I mean, crime is committed in communities and who mm-hmm. you have access to. And we should say that R. Kelly himself was a victim of crime in the most intimate spaces, his own home. You know, he was raped repeatedly as a child.
Mm-hmm. Does that complicate, I guess, this equation? Is there some other conversation we should be having about people who are themselves survivors of sexual abuse and the boomerang effect that that could have in someone's later life?
Well, I would never try to speak as an expert about sexual violence and abuse. What I have been told by people who are experts is that, yes, almost 100% of abusers have been abused, but not 100% of people who have been abused go on to become abusers at all. R. Kelly's 51. He just turned 52. And what I wish had happened back when R. Kelly was 27 and had had this illegal marriage, which was quickly annulled, to Aaliyah, was that his team, people around him, his record label, anyone, his family, would have done a deep intervention.
Do you think that the fact that R. Kelly was so cloistered within black communities explained any of the lag around taking these allegations more seriously?
I mean, I think that we didn't take these allegations, or that he was cloistered, as you say. One of them is we filmed a protest in Detroit of the Mute R. Kelly concert, and you see me outside of the concert asking people, do they feel any reticence to walk into this arena and give their money to this man who for at least 25 years has been accused of abusing black girls? And they, you know, had the art versus artist, you know, answer for me, and or that he's not guilty.
I am a R. Kelly fan.
It's two sides to every story.
I'm here for the music and nothing else. And
so there is this love that he has from black folks that is both a currency and a protection. And there's this very convenient way that we have talked about him being found not guilty as if he's innocent.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that.
Well, we know that black men are often targeted unjustly. In fact, it's a deep shame that black women have handing over black men to this system that we know to be both unjust and that targets them. At the same time, black women are black people, and we too are targeted and, you know, treated unjustly in this system. In fact, most sexual violence survivors don't find justice in this system, regardless of race.
So what do you think should happen with R. Kelly?
You know, I want justice for these women, and I would like them to define that, you know, what restitution looks like for them. They're never going to get back what they lost in these, like, very critical years, these formative years in their lives. So I believe that if the criminal justice system can find him guilty, then so be it. I also believe in social death, you know. I believe in boycott and divestment and sanctions. It's been a practice of mine since I became political around South Africa as a 12-year-old. So I believe in that practice, and I think that he's someone that we should have turned away a long time ago.
Is there any plan for a follow-up to this documentary?
Absolutely not. I can't imagine. This was one of the darkest years of my life working on this. And I say that with all respect to the survivors who've lived with this for a lot longer than me.
Thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jelani.
Filmmaker and critic Dream Hampton, speaking with The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb about the documentary Surviving R. Kelly. You can find it on streaming services. Kelly and his lawyers have denied the charges in Hampton's film. A Georgia district attorney is now investigating Kelly.